This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's warm today. Finally feels like summer. So I'm going to roll my little Winster up here. And hopefully we'll actually get a little cool air coming out of the air conditioner. Although it's not as cool as it used to be. Maybe leaking out. May need to go get more Freon before I take my buddy. Let's see, on Tuesday, but it's the fourth Tuesday of the month, I take my buddy, or we go out to eat, which would be a couple of Tuesdays. No, Tuesday after next, so I may need to charge things up before I go get him. Anyways, it is Thursday today. It is episode 281. 19 more episodes. We will be at 300. Speaking of 19 more episodes, speaking of 19 more monthly payments on my retirement fund, I thought I had just made one and thought I only had 18 more monthly payments to go before I had sort of reached the point where if I just keep body and soul together, I will have my retirement funds together for when I retire at 66 and 7 months. Which I think I mentioned last week that I've now dropped below 11 years. It is now 10 years and 11 months. Woohoo! 11 months. 10 years and 11 months. And I'm going to retire, I think for certain. I don't know if I'm going to get retired early or not. It would be fun. That would be fun. But it's okay if I don't do. It's okay. Everything's fine. And even at this point, if I get disabled, the government is going to give me like $2,300 a month or something like that, which we'll see how long that would last. But, you know, $2,300 a month is a lot of money. We certainly would have to live much frugalier than we do now. But, you know, we can make it. We could make it. I thought I only had 19 more monthly payments on my retirement funds, and actually 18 because I just made a monthly payment. Turns out, apparently the stock market kind of went down a little bit in the last month, and so I'm not quite as far along as I thought I was. But the nice thing about running a annuity is that it does, you know, only drop to a certain level. They do, I think, every year lock me into a new threshold. So, you know, that's kind of nice that they lock into a new threshold and it really can't go down. And, you know, so that's the thing I like about the annuity. If I can get this done and get, you know, my $1 million saved up in the annuity, then basically and get my threshold set there. Basically, it sits there while I live off the $50,000 a year, and you know, I'm good. Got something to pass along to my kids. Although there are people not passing along to their kids, surprisingly enough, like, which I respect that. Bill and Melinda Gates, I was listening to something, and they were like, nope, we're going to get those kids the best education that money can buy, but that's it. They are not, and you know, you got to respect that. They're going to make their own way in the world. Money just ruins kids. Oh, yeah, you know, okay. So maybe what I'm thinking is that if I can, you know, get this $1 million saved up and then stored up while I live on it, my wife lives on it, that when I pass along, then they can just inherit it and they can use it for their retirement. And then maybe when they pass along, they can split it among their kids and their kids can use it for their retirement, you know? So we'll keep letting things piddle on out like that. Anyways, been doing some writing this week. I've had a few more people get back with me on finishing up the book, and as always, getting a variety of reactions. It's a little too much for some of my male conservative readers. But surprisingly, I haven't really had any of my female readers say it's too much yet. In fact, one of my very conservative female readers read it and just really enjoyed it. Which is a fascinating thing. It is not unexpected, but it was gratifying nonetheless when it happened. Because the book is earthy, and in particular, I have one character who is not a well-behaved woman. She has been through a bunch of stuff in her life, and she has developed a certain way of dealing with it, and she does not conform to the standards and social mores of her day. It's just very interesting. You know, the reaction, the different reactions that I've had. Some of the guys are like, that sounds good to us, you know. And they've really enjoyed it. And then I have had some of my beta readers who are a bit more, I would classify, a bit more conservative, a bit more reserved, let's put it that way, that it's just been too much for. So it's interesting. It's interesting. And I think part of the feminine experience with sensuality is an understanding that sensuality is a tool. It's not necessarily a state. And because of that, I think Falcon, who is the female character who, you know, she grew up in the night and she's done a lot of stuff and, you know, she's not necessarily repentant of the things that she has done, although she's working through it. You know, I think my female readers can at least relate to the fact that Falcon does what she needs to do to survive. And that idea of doing, of a woman doing what she needs to survive, I think that resonates with women. And, you know, I hoped that it would, but I think it does. And so while they may not approve of the types of things Falcon does, they understand them. And they're willing to give her some space. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out in the end. Because whether people realize it or not yet, I am following the poem, The Second Coming. And the first line, the first book was based on the first line, turning and turning in the widening gyre, which is the idea that everything is spiraling out of control. The first book was based on that. Well, the second book is based on the next line, the falcon cannot hear the falconer, which very much carries with it the idea that Falcon, or the falcon as she is referred to in the book, she really does not answer to any authority. She really just has her own agenda that she will execute in the way she determines she's going to execute it. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see what people's reaction is to the next book, this book that I'm writing now. And then the next line in the poem is things fall apart, the center cannot hold, which, you know, kind of gives you the idea of where that's going. So, anyways, been a good week. Got some good research done this week. I think we settled into something that we needed to come up with a strategy on in terms of how we were going to do certain things in the application I'm working on designing now. But I think we have an approach now, at least. And it's an approach which falls within the philosophical direction of where we are trying to go as an IT department. And so I had a little detour this week in examining some potential packages we could use for this and in finding out what the capabilities of those packages were and how we would do it. And then next week I'm going to go ahead and mock some things up just to make sure that it works like I think it's supposed to work. But, you know, it's good because I started down one path where it wasn't, I didn't know that it wasn't as much in the philosophical track that we were trying to get to as an IT department, but I just felt a check where you really need to go talk to your superior about this. So I went over and when I finished talking with him, I realized that I needed to do things a different way, but we were able to nail down and find an approach that I think is going to appeal to everyone. It's going to get the job done, but it's also going to put us on the philosophical track that is the desired philosophical track. So that's good. That good has all worked out. This week, I've been chatting with friends about this particular topic now for 3 or 4 weeks, maybe 4 or 5. I can't remember when I first came across this topic, but to be honest, I had to read the article and then think about it and then go back and review the article the first time, a couple of times through before I kind of got it in my head what the deal was. And I think I know what the deal is now. And to me, it's just fascinating. I knew even in my cursory read through that this was something I wanted to talk about. But now that I've been through it a couple of times and explained it to friends a couple of times, I think I understand what's going on, and it honestly amuses me to no end. Not because people are getting in distress over this, but because I think this is adequate proof of what happens when individuals decide that they are smart enough to unmoor themselves from any higher authority, from any higher design principle, and simply attempt to figure life out in a vacuum. That these types of things crop up. And at least they're being truthful about it. At least they are trying to approach it in an honest way. And unfortunately, that leads them, some of them, to great mental distress. The article that I read was titled "The Most Terrifying Thought Experiment of All Time." And it was written by a man named David Auerbach, Auerbach. He started the article with a warning. And the warning was, reading this article may commit you to an eternity of suffering and torment. Well, I was committed at that point to reading the article. So, any of these, he went through kind of some of the internet, you know, hoaxy goblins, Slenderman, Smile Dog, Goatsy, urban legends on the internet. But he said, yet none is as all-powerful and threatening as Roko's Basilisk. Roko was the name of a user. Basilisk is like a giant reptile, giant lizard. He said, for Roko's Basilisk is an evil, godlike form of artificial intelligence so dangerous that if you see it or even think about it too hard, you will spend the rest of eternity screaming in its torture chamber. It's like the videotape in The Ring. Even death is no escape, for if you die, Roko's basilisk will resurrect you and begin the torture again. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so what is Roko's basilisk? Well, in order to get to Roko's basilisk, you gotta lay the foundation with a couple of different things. He said it exists at a horizon point where philosophical thought experiment blurs into urban legend. And he said the basilisk made its first appearance on a discussion board called Less Wrong. LessWrong.com, I think it is. It's a place where intellectuals gather and they talk about all sorts of things, including living their lives optimized using mathematics and rationality, yada, yada, yada. Its founder, Eliezer Yudowsky, I think is his name, he said this guy is a significant figure in techno-futurism. So this is not just, you know, some guy off the wall guy. This is a significant figure. The article went on to document that this man's research institute, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which funds and promotes research around the advancement of artificial intelligence, has been boosted and funded by high-profile techies like Peter Thiel, Ray Kurzweil, and Yudkowsky is a prominent contributor to academic discussions of technological ethics and decision theory. So this isn't just some guy. This guy is a significant contributor in the field of technology, ethics, decision theory, the future, artificial intelligence, the singularity, yeah. Okay. So, I'll just give you the Roko's basilisk idea and Yudkowsky's reaction, and then we'll get into why. So, one day on the Less Wrong board, a user named Roko postulated a thought experiment. And the thought experiment was this. What if, in the future, a somewhat malevolent artificial intelligence were to come about and punish those who did not do its bidding? What if there were a way for this artificial intelligence to punish people today who are not helping it come into existence later? In that case, weren't the readers of Less Wrong right than being given the choice? Oh, weren't the readers of Less Wrong right then being given the choice of either helping that evil AI coming into existence, or of being condemned to suffer? So, was there a condition where a malevolent AI was going to come into being who would punish those who did not help it? And was there also not in that same condition the possibility that the people who were having these discussions on this discussion board were being identified as the ones who would not help the malevolent being, AI, come into existence, and as such, they were going to be punished for it? Okay, well, you know, normal people read that. I'm getting my mail. And I'm afraid this is going to go long already because there's a lot to explain with it. But it's worth the explanation. Okay, so that was the setup. He posted it out there. And I'm sure this user just thought, well, that'll be that. Didn't really think much of it. Oh, that's an interesting thought experiment. Roko went ballistic. He went ballistic. He responded with this post. Listen to me very closely, you idiot. And then he started writing in all caps, which on the internet, if you don't know, is a sign that you're shouting. One moment, let me get back into my garage. Backing into my garage. Yada, yada, yada. Okay, so listen very closely, you idiot. This is in caps, he's shouting. You do not think in sufficient detail about superintelligences considering whether or not to blackmail you. This is the only possible thing which gives them a motive to follow through on the blackmail. And then he continued, and he wasn't in caps. You have to be really clever to come up with a genuinely dangerous thought. I am disheartened that people who can be clever enough to do that and not clever, to do the obvious thing and in caps, keep their idiot mouths shut about it. Because it is much more important to sound intelligence when talking to your friends. This post was, in caps, stupid. Yudkowsky said that Roku had already given nightmares to several less wrong users and had brought them to the point of a breakdown. Yudkowsky ended up deleting the thread completely, thus assuring that Roku's basilisk would become the stuff of legend. It was a thought experiment so dangerous that merely thinking about it was hazardous not only to your mental health, but to your very fate. Now, at this point, if you haven't been down this road, you're probably thinking, what? What? Okay, so here, follow along. This comes down to the coming singularity. The artificial intelligence people have predicted that within the next 50 years, there will be a singularity, that there will be an intelligence that will be capable of reproducing and improving itself in artificial intelligence, and that it will grow smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter, and then it will exceed human intelligence, and the sky's the limit after that. Boom. Okay. So the big question on everybody's mind at this point, is this thing going to be malevolent or benevolent? Or as the article says, benevolent or malicious? That's a big question. A lot of people talking about, a lot of people on either side of it, trying to understand, you know, blah, 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 blah. One of the things that people are postulating will come out about this is that we will never have to die then, because the computing technology will be sufficient to actually be able to mimic the human brain, and therefore we will be able to download our brain into this entity or some subsection of this entity and be able to live out the rest of our lives just as if we had a human body, because we would have all the sensations. That this entity would also be able to produce simulations. So you would have a simulated world where you could live in your own world and do what you wanted, and everything would be hunky-dory fine, and it would be great. Which, honestly, as a sidebar, I spent a lot of time when I was a little kid, 9, 10 years old, thinking about existence. Because I think I'm sitting here staring out of my eyes right now. How weird is this? I'm experiencing this life right now. It's me. And this idea of consciousness and this idea of living from moment to moment has always been something that's just fascinated me. And if I thought about it too long, it would just make me feel really weird. So I spend my life just trundling along, just taking consciousness for granted. And then just every once in a while, it's like, yeah, isn't this interesting? Anyways, so there are scientists that believe in this singularity so much that they are taking steps to try to ensure they're going to get there. In the article, it talks about the fact that Ray Kurzweil is chugging 150 vitamins a day to stay alive until the singularity. While Yudkowsky and Peter Thiel have enthused about cryonics, the perennial favorite of rich dudes who want to live forever. Quote, if you don't sign up your kids for cryonics, then you are a lousy parent, Yudkowsky writes. Okay, so these guys, they really believe that the singularity is coming. And Yudkowsky's foundation, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, has the explicit goal of steering the future towards a friendly AI. This is easily the biggest issue for them. The environment is not the issue. Politics is not the issue. To them, the singularity brings about the machine equivalent of God itself, and they are trying to do everything in their power to ensure that it is benevolent. Okay, so set that aside for a moment. Now let's talk about something called timeless decision theory. And I've got to go through this quick because I'm way over time. Basically, here's the deal. You have two boxes. In one box, there is $1,000. We'll call that box A. In another box, there is either nothing or $1,000,000. We'll call that box B. Now then, if someone said you have to choose one box, box A has $1,000, box B will either have nothing or $1,000,000. You can either choose both boxes or just box B. What do you want to do? Okay, so, well, most of us sensible people would just say, well, I'll just choose both boxes. Or some of the high flyers among us would just choose box B. But it's kind of a big debate, and you can either be a one boxer or a two boxer in this discussion. Now what you do is you introduce another factor. And by being a two-boxer, you're basically saying, well, I'm guaranteed $1,000, so why don't I do that? By being a one-boxer, you're saying, you know, well, it might be nothing in there, but I'll take a flyer on it. Maybe it'll be $1,000,000, so I'll be a one-boxer. Okay, but you introduce something new into the equation. You say, oh, there is this superintelligence that is benevolent, and this superintelligence knows what you're going to do. He has the ability to simulate what you're going to do. And it has already decided what you're going to do. And if you just pick box B, it's going to give you $1,000,000. It's going to put $1,000,000 in the box. But if you pick both boxes, it's only going to put $1,000 in box A, and it's going to put nothing in box B. So that means if you pick both boxes, if the benevolent artificial intelligence knows what you're going to do, you're only going to make $1,000. But if you pick box B, you're going to make $1,000,000, so long as it's right. Well, how do you know if it's going to be right? It's never been wrong. You're told it's never been wrong. So what should you do? Lots of people come down on both sides of the arguments. There is one very telling way to approach this, then. And that is that you always pick box B. Always, 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 always. Even if the benevolent AI has a chance of being wrong. And the reason you always pick box B is because when you're making the decision, you don't know for sure if you're actually making that decision or the artificial intelligence has simulated you making that decision. And in order to simulate you accurately, it has to completely simulate your life. Therefore, the simulated you inside the simulation would have no way of knowing that it wasn't real. And so, therefore, what you need to do is you need to always pick box B, because you want things to go in your favor. So You want the artificial intelligence to think that you're going to pick box B so that it'll put $1 million in there so that when you really pick box B, it comes out in your favor. So you always pick box B. Okay, now that we've got that done, now let's back up. Now let's change the boxes. All right. So now let's change the boxes to where it is a malevolent, it is a malicious AI now. And the malicious AI has a choice of choosing both boxes, and box A has helping the malicious AI come into being. And box B either has nothing or eternal torment. So you can either choose both boxes and help the malevolent being come into existence, or you can choose box B and not help the malevolent being come into existence, and chance that you won't be committed to a life of eternal torment. If you pick both boxes, it's a toss-up. You may or may not be committed, but you will be helping a malevolent entity come into being. If you just choose box B, it's still a toss-up, but at least you're not going to help the malevolent being come into being. Now, the additional thing is the malevolent being decides that if it knows you're going to choose box B, that it's going to fill that box with eternal torment. So now, if you don't want eternal torment, your choice really only is to always pick both boxes and hope that the malevolent being doesn't fill the second box with eternal torment, even though you helped it come into being. And so basically, you're cooked. And what has been so upsetting to people is that as soon as this idea comes into the world, that the malevolent entity can extort people into helping it, because this thought experiment really blackmails them into helping if they believe all this stuff. And some people really, really do believe all this stuff. That the fact that someone came up with this as an idea means that if a malevolent entity comes into existence, it will use this idea on the people who would believe it. So if you find yourself thinking about this, then in fact the malevolent entity may already exist, and you are merely being simulated to find out what you will do. And frankly, there's not much way, if you believe all this stuff, to back your way out of this. I mean, once it's in, it's in. In fact, Rocco, for his part, the article says, put the blame on Les Wrong for spurring him to the idea of the basilisk in the first place. Quote, I wished very strongly that my mind had never come across the tools to inflict such large amounts of potential self-harm, he wrote. Now, quite rightly, the writer of the article said, if you do not subscribe to the theories that underline Rocco's basilisk and thus feel no temptation to bow down to your once and future evil machine lord, then Rocco's basilisk poses you no threat. He put in parentheses, this is ironic that it's only a mental health risk to those who have already bought into Yudowsky's thinking. Believing in Rocco's basilisk may simply be a referendum on autism, as a friend put it. But I do believe there's a more serious issue at work here, because Yudkowsky and other so-called transhumanists are attracting so much prestige and money for their projects, primarily from rich techies. And I don't think their projects, which only seem to involve publishing papers and hosting conferences, have much chance of creating either Rocco's basilisk or Eliezer's big friendly God. But the combination of messianic ambitions, being convinced of your own infallibility, and a lot of cash never works out well, regardless of the ideology, and I don't expect Yudkowsky and his cohorts to be an exception. And that's very true. And then he goes on in the article to say that he worries less about the Basculus than he does about people who believe themselves to have transcended conventional morality. Because like his projected friendly AIs, Yudkowsky is a moral utilitarian. He believes that the greatest good for the greatest number of people is always ethically justifiable, even if a few people have to die or suffer along the way. He has explicitly argued that given the choice, it is preferable to torture a single person for 50 years than for a sufficient number of people, to be fair, a lot of people, to get dust specks in their eyes. No one, even God, is likely to face that choice. But here's a different case. What if a snarky slate tech columnist writes about a thought experiment that can destroy people's mind, thus hurting people and blocking friendly progress towards the singularity and friendly AI? In that case, any potential good that could come from my life would be far outweighed by the harm I'm causing. And should the cryogenically sustained Eliezer Yudkowsky emerge with the singularity and decide to simulate whether or not I write this column, please, almighty Eliezer, don't torture me. Okay, so cute ending to the column. Really well-written column. Very, very interesting. But again, this is what comes about when people don't have a ground of being, and they're very intelligent people, and they think about stuff a lot, and they end up tying themselves in a knot, because you can tie yourself in a knot. Even we, as those who would ascribe to the Christian faith, once you begin thinking about this ability of supercomputers to simulate things, there's a bunch of things come to mind, like by his foreknowledge, he did predestine us. What does that mean? Does that mean that God simulated the world and that's how he knows what's going to happen? Or is it just plain that God exists outside time? And are those two really that functionally different? If God has sufficient resources in himself to simulate exactly how a world would, you know, flow out once he said, let there be light, and he could do that in nearly instantaneous time frames to him, that he could just see the whole thing at once before he actually said, let there be light, and move it out, is there really anything functionally different between the simulation and the actual development? And then are we in the simulation? Are we in the actual reality? I mean, certainly you can tie yourself up in knots. For me, what it comes down to is I know there's no way I can know for sure where I am or what's happening in reality. I can only live my life a day at a time. And I have chosen to believe, and I have seen it in my experience, that the best path forward in life is a life of kindness and generosity, of love, of grace, of mercy, of diligence and discipline. And that I get such benefit from those things. And by benefit, I don't mean simply that I'm comfortable financially. It is the benefit of the soul that I'm talking about. This peace and this joy and this settledness, that I have built my life on something that works. I get so much out of the way I have chosen to live my life that it really doesn't bother me that I don't know for certain whether the path I've chosen is correct or not, because I'm not really missing out on anything by doing this path. I know that my flesh would like to tell me that I am, but I have also had enough observations of enough people that even those people who have gone down the path that I think sometimes I might want to follow, yeah, in the end, doesn't work out so good. And they eventually all come back to me and say, yeah, you know, this wasn't worth it. And I just go, oh, well, now you know. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home. Sorry for the long, 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 long podcast this time.